The lady is a force to be reckoned with, Parker agreed. She and my wife have become quite close, you know. I've warned Zanair to be cautious, and you all know Zan is no fool. But she obviously approves of Madame Parsan. She thinks she's one of the smartest people she's ever met, too. That's Timon and Owain Quentin's view as well, Maiden agreed. I know, Parker nodded. But what the Quentins may not know is that Madame Parsan's purchasing agents, she seems to have been very careful to keep well away from the House of Quentin, and her official legal investments have now taken possession of something over 8,000 rifled muskets, which have all mysteriously disappeared since. What? Godard stared at him, and the seneschal chuckled sourly. Haraiman did tell us she was investing in rifles, he pointed out, and we told him, unofficially of course, to go ahead and sell them to her as a way to finance some additional manufacturing capacity without any investment on our part. He shrugged. Obviously I'd prefer to be doing the investing and stockpiling the weapons ourselves, but if there's one thing Clintrand's agents have to be looking for, it's evidence we're involving ourselves in some major rearmament program without mentioning it to Mother Church. I understand all that, the Keeper of the Seal said a bit impatiently. I was part of the discussion, remember, but 8,000 rifles. It would appear Madame Parsan had rather more to invest than we thought when we told Haraiman to sell her whatever she ordered, Parker said a bit whimsically. I wonder what she would have done if he'd offered to make artillery for her. What in hell, if you'll pardon my language, does she plan to do with that many rifles? Godard asked Stoner, and the Lord Protector shrugged. Something Clintrand won't like, I hope. In the meantime, though, unless we want to take official cognizance of her and ask her if she'd be so kind as to hand them over to us, I think we need to plan on the basis of what we know we have and what we're afraid Poccovert and Earnhardt may have managed to make available on their side of the hill. Suggestions, anyone? The honour to be, etc., etc., Sir Regis Dragoner said, looking out across the city of Sidar, drowsing peacefully under a golden September afternoon sun. He sighed, then turned and stood with his back to the window, watching Wynne Thurston's busy pen jot down the last few words. "I'll trust you to finish it up properly," he said with a smile which was only slightly forced. "Yes, Ambassador." Wynne looked up with a smile of her own. It wasn't much of a smile, but Dragoner was glad to see it anyway. She hadn't smiled very often since losing not simply her brother, but her favourite cousin as well in the Hayratha powder mill explosion. I'm sure I can come up with a properly respectful closing. I knew I could count on you. Serald was right about how useful you've been, and not just taking dictation and dealing with the correspondence. I've valued your input on a lot of issues, Wynne. You realise that, I hope. I've tried to be useful, Sir Regis, she said with a small bob of her head, but the fleeting smile had disappeared again. I only wish I thought it was really going to do some good. All we can do is the best we can do. Dragoner's tone was firmer and more optimistic than he truly felt, and he was pretty sure Wynne knew it. He truly was glad Zerald Maris, his secretary of many years, had managed to find Madame Thurston for him, and not just because she was a skilled stenographer and secretary. He could always use more people with that set of skills, but she was also smart, and it was that, coupled with the many years she had lived in the Republic, which made her truly valuable to him. She understood Sidamarkians in ways he simply didn't, despite how long he'd been posted as the Carisian ambassador to the Republic. "And you might as well admit it, Regis," he told himself now, turning back to the window. "You value her, because she's your window into the Carisian temple loyalists here in the city, too." "Do you really think it's as bad as some people seem to be saying, Sir Regis?" she asked now, and he shrugged. "I think it's not as good as I wish it were," he said. "Let's just put it that way." He shrugged again. "All we can do is warn people to be careful, to avoid provocations, and for any of them who can, to return to Caris." "I've lived here almost half my entire life, Sir Regis," Wynne said with an unusual flash of fire. "I'm not going to just run away from my neighbours and my friends and my family and all the rest of my life because some people are letting their mouths run away with them." "I hope that's all it is," he said, turning back around to look at her. "You've seen the dispatches I'm sending home, though. You probably know more about what's happening here in the capital than I do when it comes down to it. And you know I'm trying hard not to be alarmist and make a bad situation worse. But I'd be derelict in my duties if I didn't warn the Carisian community about the rumours we're picking up." "Why did we ever have to start all this?" she asked, her eyes pained. "It's all just crazy, Sir Regis." "In some ways I agree with you," he said heavily. In fact, he agreed with her in a lot more ways than he was prepared to admit. His personal balancing act as a loyal son of Mother Church and the ambassador of the heretical Empire of Caris had become nothing but more difficult as the Church moved steadily towards an official declaration of jihad. Over the last year, since that declaration had actually come, it had gotten even harder, and deep inside himself he wondered what he was going to do if worse came to worst in the Republic. Only his overriding sense of duty to the House of Armagh had kept him at his post this long, and he didn't know if even that could have done the trick if he hadn't seen so many indications Mother Church was striving to keep the Republic as close to neutral territory as it could. He had had enough clear signs, signals that could only have come from Vicar Robert and Chancellor Trinair, that Mother Church actually wanted the embargo to continue leaking in Sidamark's case. That had been enough to keep him in his office, still able to serve both of the causes which were so dear to his heart. But if that balance was shifting, if Mother Church was changing her mind, what did he do then? "In some ways, I agree with you," he repeated. "But we live when we live, and all any of us can do is pray for guidance to get through all this without trading away any more of our souls than we have to. And if we get an opportunity to do something which may make it even a little better, or at least less bad than it would have been otherwise, then we give thanks on our knees." "Yes, sir." Wynne lowered her eyes, seeming a bit abashed at having spoken out, and he inhaled deeply. "Go ahead and get clear copies of those written up," he told her in a gentler tone. "And tell Zerild we're going to have a special dispatch bag for Tellisburg."
"Of course, sir."
"And, Wynne, if you'd like to send any messages home to Caris, feel free to use the dispatch bag." She looked up at him and he smiled at her. "I know you don't abuse the privilege, and at least this way they'll get home a little quicker."
"Thank you, Sir Regis. I appreciate it."
Wynne gathered up her notepad and her pen and headed down the hall to her own little cubbyhole of an office. The door closed quietly behind her, and Dragoner returned his attention to the window, looking across those sunlit roofs at North Bay's sail-dotted azure water, and thinking about the homeland which lay so far beyond it. Wynne Thurston closed her office door behind her and sat in the creaky, slightly rickety chair at her desk. She laid her shorthand notes on the blotter and stared down at them, thinking about them, wondering what she should do. Then she leaned back, closed her eyes and covered her lids with her hands while she tried not to weep. There were times she felt almost unbearably torn by guilt as she sat in Sir Regis's office, taking down his words, working on his correspondence, answering his questions about the Carisian and non-Carisian communities here in Cedar City.
It was wrong of her to feel that way, she knew that. She wasn't doing anything she shouldn't be doing, and Sir Regis was a good man, one who needed her help. She could see how he was aging before her, the way his hair was going progressively whiter, the lines carving themselves more and more deeply into his face. He'd revealed more of his own spiritual turmoil than he thought he had, she was pretty sure of that, and she wondered how much longer he could bear it, and how he was going to react when the inevitable happened. And it was inevitable. She lowered her hands again, staring at the icon of the Archangel Langhorne hanging on the wall above her desk. God couldn't permit any other outcome, but why did it have to be so hard? Why did so many people, good people, and there were good people on both sides, have to die? The tears came despite her efforts to stop them, as she thought of her brother Trey and her cousin Irvin. Sir Regis had tried so hard to comfort her when the terrible news came, tried to tell her it had all been some horrible accident, but Wynne knew better. She couldn't be certain, of course, but she knew better. If only Irvin had been able to see the truth the way she and Trey had. But he hadn't, and they'd lost him to the heresy, and she'd still loved him so much, and, oh, sweet Bedard, but it hurt so much to be so sure Trey had killed him. And himself. Forgive him, she prayed now, staring at the image of the Archangel on the wall before her, not entirely certain if she were praying for her heretical cousin or the brother who had violated divine law by taking his own life. But then she shook herself. God couldn't possibly condemn Trey for giving up his life in his own service. Yet even so, forgive all of them, please. I know Irvin and the others are wrong. I know it's all so horribly wrong, but they're not really evil. They're doing what they think they have to do, what they think you and God want them to do. Do they really have to spend all of eternity paying for that? The icon didn't answer her, but she hadn't really expected it to, and she drew a deep breath, a decisive breath. She had wanted to do more from the very beginning, but Trey had convinced her no, to be honest. He'd ordered her not to. She remembered that first letter of his, the one which had filled her with mingled fear and elation. It was so like her big brother to take charge, to know exactly what to do, and she'd taken his warning seriously. She had never said a single word to anyone, not even her own priest and confessor, about the personal letters to her, which she relayed to her husband's aunt in Zion. The letters which went from there directly to the office of the Inquisition, and the replies to which were transmitted to him in her own personal letters. She had no idea what information and what instructions had passed back and forth, because Trey had been very clear about that as well. At his request, the Inquisition had sent him a code book by an entirely separate route. She didn't know what it had been, and he and whoever he was actually writing to had buried their messages in the word puzzles and acrostics he and Wynne had shared regularly by mail ever since her marriage had taken her to the Republic so many years before. But he'd been very specific in that first letter. She was to do nothing but relay letters. That was the most important thing she could possibly do, and she mustn't do anything that could compromise her ability to perform that task. So she'd had no contact at all with the Inquisition here in Siddar. She had spoken as calmly and reasonably as she could when the inevitable debates erupted between temple loyalists and adherents of the Church of Caris, avoiding anything which could have gotten her labelled an extremist by either side. And she had never, not once, used her privileged position here inside the embassy to provide information to Mother Church. In a lot of ways, she had been grateful Trey's instructions had precluded her from doing that. But Trey was gone now, and Irwin, both of them sacrificed to the war impious man had declared upon God himself, and that meant she was free. It would be a betrayal of Sir Regis' trust, and she regretted that deeply. Yet she had no choice but to serve God and the archangels in any way she could. She drew another deep breath and began transcribing her notes in the beautiful, clear handwriting she had been taught as a child in Tellersburg. She had the dispatch bag to catch, and she would. But this time, instead of destroying her original notes the way she always had before, she would take them with her when she left. It was very quiet in the tiny office, with only the soft, purposeful scratching of her pen to break the silence. 8. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands.
God damn them! God damn all of them!
Zaspar Clintan threw the entire file across the sitting room of his luxurious personal suite. It hit the outer wall's unbreakable, transparent crystal with a thump and flew back, scattering pages across the thick, rich carpets, and the Grand Inquisitor snarled. His heavy jowled face was purple with fury as he snatched up a priceless glass paperweight that was over 300 years old and hurled it across the room, directly into a glass-fronted cabinet of crystal decanters. It struck with an ear-shattering crash, and the sharp scent of expensive brandies and whiskies as paperweight glass and bottles exploded in fragments. Spectacular as it was, the destruction had no apparent effect on Clintan's rage, and he bent and snatched up the bronze coffee table. It had to weigh 100 pounds, Willem Reyno thought, but the Grand Inquisitor didn't even seem to notice. He only hurled it after the paperweight with an explosive grunt of effort, demolishing the entire wet bar in a cascade of shattered snifters, goblets, liqueur bottles, and exquisite and exquisitely expensive cabinetry. The Archbishop of Qianwu made himself as small and inconspicuous as he possibly could. It wasn't the first time he had seen Clintan explode in all but incoherent fury, but it was never a pleasant experience. And he had seldom seen the Grand Inquisitor this angry. In fact, it was entirely possible, he had never seen Clintan this angry. Not even Zaspar Clintan, in the grip of a monumental rage, could throw something as heavy as that coffee table without consequences. He stumbled, nearly falling, and kept himself on his feet only by grabbing the back of a couch. He snarled, shoved himself back upright, and kicked the couch halfway across the room. It knocked over a display pedestal and a marble bust of the Archangel Chihiro, carved from life by the 2nd-century master Chaken, toppled to the floor in a crunching, face-first impact that sent fragments of white stone flying. He looked around as if seeking something else expensive to destroy, then stomped out of the sitting room, kicking heirloom furniture out of his way, and Reyno heard more shattering sounds from the adjacent bedchamber. Fortunately, Clintan hadn't ordered the Archbishop to accompany him, and Reyno breathed a quiet prayer of thanks as he tucked his hands into the sleeves of his cassock and prepared to wait out his superior's rage. From the sounds of things, it was going to take a while. All right, Clintan said flatly, the better part of 2 hours later. Give me the details. He and Reyno had withdrawn to the small conference room attached to the Grand Inquisitor's suite. The door had opened at their approach, and then closed silently behind them. Cool air whispered through the overhead ducts, and the conference room soundproofing guaranteed that none of the white-faced servants, creeping about while they dealt with the wreckage littering the wake of Clintan's rage, would hear a word they said. Reyno considered pointing out that all the details he possessed had been contained in the file, but he didn't consider it very hard. He'd quietly gathered up the file's scattered contents and brought them with him, but reminding Clintan he'd cleaned up behind him probably wouldn't be a good idea.
I'm afraid there's not a great deal to add to what I've already told you, Your Grace, he said just a bit cautiously.
The destruction appears to be effectively total. Jarrah's entire fleet seems to have been sunk, burned, or taken. All the naval yard facilities were burned. The artillery founderies in and around Ithria were all destroyed, and the port's batteries were blown up. As nearly as I can tell, Your Grace, the Imperial Desnarian Navy now consists solely of the 21 galleons in Desnare Bay. And, in all honesty, Your Grace, I'll be astounded if the heretics don't move against Desnare, the city, very soon now. His mouth twisted. They made it clear enough at Ithria that they're not afraid to confront heavy fortifications or our galleons, and I don't think there's anything at Desnare that could stop them if Jarrah couldn't stop them at Ithria. No. Clintan glared at him, jowls tinged with just a hint of the purple which had suffused them earlier. What about a fucking commander with at least a little guts? He snarled. What about a goddamned navy that remembers its fucking fighting for God? Reno started to reply, then paused. From the casualty reports he'd read, and which Clintan had gotten to before he'd launched off into his paroxysm of fury, the Desnarian navy had fought and died hard before its final surrender. He thought about pointing out that of the 90-plus ships with which Jarrah had begun the action, the Carisians had kept only 35 or 40 as prizes. The others had been so badly damaged, Rock Point had ordered them burned. That didn't strike him as the sort of damage a fleet that gave up easily suffered. And Jarrah, after battle report, had pulled no punches about the devastating advantage the Carisians' new ammunition had provided them. No, there'd been nothing wrong with the fighting spirit of Ithria's defenders, not until after Jarrah's surrender, at least. But pointing that out would be impolitic. I trust we have both of those things at Desnare's.
Hello, the woman, as she made her way through the forest.
Do you think the vampire is here?
Juliet asked. Reardon did another, much more careful and thorough scan of the surrounding forest.
If so, he is a master at hiding his presence. I know they are getting much more clever about such things, so we will need to be fully alert to all danger to her. She is drawn to Manolito, and perhaps can find him even faster than we can, as he is shielding his presence from me.
Juliet frowned as they began to follow Marianne.
Your blood bond should keep you informed of his whereabouts.
Reardon sent her a small smile.
We are ancients, Juliet, and we have studied many things over the centuries. Manolito can hide his presence even from our best hunters, and there is no detecting Zacharias when he does not want it known that he is near.
Marianne realized tears were running down her face. The sense of dread and fear was overwhelming.
Where are you?
Cowardice in removing themselves from Clintan's reach. And, unless he was mistaken, before their departure they'd done their best to report honestly and accurately and warningly on what they'd faced when the Carisian Navy came to call. Best not to make that point just yet, either, though. Our inability to operate with any degree of flexibility in Caris is going to work against us as well, he continued instead. At the moment, I don't think it would be possible to send in any of our agents to deal with them. Getting to them is going to require something like Operation Rakurai, and until we know exactly where the heretics are keeping them, even beginning to plan that kind of mission is going to be impractical, I'm afraid. Clintan growled something under his breath, but he also gave another of those jerky nods. In fact, his colour seemed to improve a little, and Reno congratulated himself on having brought up Operation Rakurai. There'd been too little time for any reports to reach Zion yet, so it was impossible to say how well the Rakurai had fared. Clintan anticipated a high degree of effectiveness, however, and contemplating that seemed to take at least the worst edge off his fury over Ithria. Of course, if it turned out Operation Rakurai had been a failure and not a success, his rage would simply return in redoubled force. But as the writ said, sufficient unto the day was the evil thereof.
All right, the Grand Inquisitor said again after a moment. I'll accept that, for now. But I want every member of their families who didn't flee with them. I want them here in Zion, Willem. All of them. You understand me?
Of course, Your Grace. Reno bowed slightly across the conference table. In fact, I'd already anticipated your wishes. I've detailed a team of our most reliable inquisitors to oversee the process of taking them into custody.
Good,
Clintan grunted, then reached out and dragged the battered file away from Reno. He opened it, and the Archbishop unobtrusively held his breath. This time, however, the Grand Inquisitor didn't explode. His lips tightened and his brows lowered as he turned through the pages, yet he had himself back under control, and his eyes darted over the sentences of the various reports. Clintan was a very fast reader. Even so, it took him the better part of 20 minutes to work through the file, during which Reno sat quietly, his expression one of calm, attentive patience. Finally, the Grand Inquisitor finished, slapped the file shut again, and shoved it away from him.
Well, that's a fine pile of dragon shit, he observed, in something very like a calm voice. Jarras was obviously trying to cover his own ass, but I notice his report dated before Coleman's decision to just hand over the entire fucking city. That probably means there's at least a trace of accuracy in it somewhere.
That was my own impression, Your Grace.
Well, if there is, we obviously need to push our own development of these shells harder. Remind me to kick Elaine in the arse and find out how he's coming.
Of course, Your Grace. Clintan sat silent for another 2 or 3 minutes, lips pursed, eyes focused on something only he could see. Then he stirred in his chair once more and refocused his attention on Reno.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me is that they went after Ithria, not Desnair, the city. I know Jarras had a lot bigger fleet base there, so I suppose it makes sense for them to have gone after it. But Desnair's only, what, 500 miles farther from Taro than Ithria, and it's the Desnarian's capital. And let's be honest, Willem, Desnair's fortifications aren't any tougher than Ithria's were. So surely they had to have been at least tempted to go after the capital first. Think of what a fist in the eye that would have been.
I hadn't really considered that aspect of it, Your Grace.
Reno considered, adding that one reason he hadn't was that Ithria had represented well over 3/4 of Desnair's total shipbuilding capacity. And, for another, the Gulf of Jarras was, or had been, at least, far more important than Desnair Bay from any commercial perspective. With the Gulf under Carizian control, the Desnarian Empire's internal economy had taken a significant blow which was going to have major consequences in the not-so-distant future. The psychological impact of an attack on Desnair, the city, might have been profound, but from a hard-boiled military and economic perspective, there was no comparison between that and the value of the attack the Carizians had actually executed.
And the defection of 2 of the Empire's most prominent nobles, one of whom just happened to be the Navy Minister and the other of whom just happened to be the Navy's commanding officer, is probably a fairly adequate psychological substitute for attacking the capital, he reflected sourly.
Well, it's obvious to me, Clintan emphasized the pronoun, that they went after Ithria first because it's closer to Silkia and Sidamark.
Reno managed not to blink. It had been painfully obvious for years that the Carizians had no intention of drawing the Church's attention any more forcefully than it could to avoid the Silkian and Sidamarkian evasion of the Grand Inquisitor's embargo. Clearly, they'd wanted to do nothing to imperil that highly lucrative trade. In fact, as far as he could see, they'd probably decided to attack Ithria because of its military importance, despite its proximity to Silkia, rather than because of it. "What do you think they're trying to accomplish, Your Grace?" he asked cautiously.
"Oh, it's obvious, Willem," Clintan retorted impatiently. "From the moment Harper blundered straight into disaster last year, the heretics have seen the opportunity to completely neutralize Mother Church's naval power in eastern waters. They're probably planning on getting around to Desnair the city sometime soon. And then, eventually, they'll go around the tip of Howard and demonstrate how gutless Thirsk is when the pressure's really on." His jaw tightened. "We're going to have to seriously consider putting somebody from the Navy of God in command of all our naval forces, since it's obvious our secular commanders aren't up to the task. Of course, Harper didn't exactly cover himself with glory either, now did he?" Reyno nodded silently, his mouth prudently shut, and Clintan grunted like an angry boar. Then he shook himself. "But back to my point. It's obvious that now they've cleared all our naval power out of eastern waters, from the Sea of Justice to the Icewind Sea. They'll take advantage of that to establish still closer economic ties with Sidama. Hell, there's not even a frigging rowboat left now to see what they're really sending in and out of that bastard Stonar's harbours, is there? We don't have squat in the way of an eastern naval presence after this. You think somebody like Stonar, or like Caleb, for that matter, won't take advantage of that? They've just blown the embargo completely out of their way. And trust me, that son of a bitch Stonar's just waiting for the reformist movement in the Republic to get strong enough before he opens the door and invites in a military Carizian presence. He especially wants those new rifles and field pieces of theirs. Think what the Sidamachian army could do with those added to its arsenal. You think he doesn't just lie awake at night, drooling over the possibility? Of course he does. And the Carizians know it too. That's why they went after Ithria. Because it's closer to Sidamach, and to Silkia, of course. And it's going to have more impact in Sidamach. They could care less what the effect in Desnair is. They want to show the Republic that they can go anywhere the hell they want and do anything the hell they choose to encourage the reformists to turn against Mother Church openly, and to reassure Stoner that they can assist him militarily when he seizes the opportunity to finally bury his dagger in Mother Church's back. Reyno started to reply, then stopped and considered. He wasn't at all sure he shared the logic process which had led the Grand Inquisitor to his conclusion, and he was even less confident that the possibility of a direct military alliance with Sidamach had played any part in the Carizian decision to attack Ithria. As far as he could see, that had been purely an example of their going after the most immediate, valuable, and most immediately threatening military objective they could strike. Yet none of that meant their triumph wasn't going to have exactly the effect Clintan had just described. Not instantly, perhaps, but in the fullness of time. And while Reyno had always been less than convinced that Gregar Stonar was simply biding his time until the moment was ripe to move against the border states and the temple lands, that had been when the entire world wasn't already at war. Not only that, it had been before the Inquisition began preparing the Sword of Shula against the Republic. Unless the Lord Protector was far, far stupider than Reyno could bring himself to believe, Stonar had to have become at least partially aware of the sword. It was unlikely he realized everything Clintan and Reyno had in mind, and even if he did, it was even less likely he'd be able to survive. But he was almost certainly picking up at least some warning signs. And if he did decide what had happened at Ithria strengthened his hand, and especially if it encouraged the Sidamachian reformists, he probably would begin cautiously exploring options with Caris. "I see your thinking now, Your Grace," he said. "Of course, it's unlikely Stonar will be able to act on the opportunity before the sword strikes." "I know that's the plan," Clintan said, And hopefully Rakorai is going to have knocked the bastard Carisians back on their heels, at least for a little bit, too. But they surprised us with this one, Willem. Let's not pretend they didn't. And everything we're hearing suggests the reformists are gaining ground steadily in Siddermark. At least some of those bastards are likely to come out openly in support of Stonar when the coin finally drops. For that matter, they're gaining ground in other places, too. He glowered at Raynor across the table, and the Archbishop nodded. Despite what the church was reporting, the truth, which had a nasty tendency of leaking out through the producers of those accursed anti-church broadsheets the Inquisition still couldn't run to ground, was that the Church of Caris wasn't being heroically and defiantly resisted in the conquered territories. That was to be expected in Old Caris itself, and probably to some extent in Emerald as well, if only due to the princedom's proximity to the original source of the contagion. Yet the truth was that Chisholm, which definitely wasn't right next door to Old Caris, had reacted with appalling calmness to its renegade queen's decision to actually marry the heretic king of Caris. Still worse, in some ways, Zebediah had done the same. In fact, from all reports, Zebediah was actively embracing the Carisian Empire, and if that meant accepting the Church of Caris as well, its subject seemed perfectly willing to do that too. No doubt that was largely an inevitable reaction to how cordially hated Tommy Simmons had been. But that wasn't keeping it from happening. And worst of all, "You're thinking about Coruscant, Your Grace?" "I'm thinking about everywhere the goddamn Carisians go," Clintan said sourly. "But yes, Coruscant was the other major ulcer I had in mind. I know our reports from Manchia are always out of date by the time they get here, and I know you've been trying to put the best face on the ones we do get." He shot Raynor a moderately frigid look. "But the goddamned reformists are obviously gaining ground in Coruscant. And the dog and lizard show that bit Charlian put on when she was down there is only pushing that process along. The damned Coruscantians are going over to Caris just like the Chisholmians and the Zebedians, and you know it, Willem." Unfortunately, Raynor did know it. And he had been trying to put the best face on his reports from Coruscant, for that matter. It would have been nice if there'd been some actual good news in any of them, though. It seemed evident to him, although even now he didn't propose to point it out to Clintan, that there'd always been a much greater reformist sentiment in Coruscant than anyone in Zion had realized. That sentiment hadn't extended, initially at least, to actually embracing schism and heresy, yet it had been there. And it had grown only stronger after Clintan broke the reformist circle in Zion itself. Raynor understood why the Grand Inquisitor had done it, yet there was no point pretending Coruscant, insulated from the object lesson by all of the salt water between it and the mainland, hadn't reacted with revulsion and anger. That had helped push more Coruscantians into the arms of the Church of Caris. And the careful way in which Caleb and Charlian had handled their occupation, coupled with Charlian's display of mercy in pardoning so many who had been convicted of treason, had drastically undermined the purely secular anger evoked by Hector's murder. Especially when she had gone right on displaying mercy after she had so nearly been killed on her throne. For that matter, the original outrage engendered by Hector's assassination had begun to fade even before Northern Conspiracy's leaders had been arrested, far less convicted. So, yes, the damned Coruscantians were going over to Caris. "The other thing we have to face here, Willem," Clintan continued flatly, "is that we're getting our ass kicked every time we go up against the Carisians at sea. Don't think anybody inclined to consider heresies missing that point either. Hopefully the Rakorai are going to have demonstrated by now that we're not powerless when it comes to striking back. But the military momentum's clearly on the heretic side for right now,
and that's giving them the impetus where morale's concerned as well. We need to grab that momentum back, regain the upper hand psychologically the way we had it after we snuffed out the Wilsons' conspiracy. Finally getting around to punishing those bastards Thirst captured was a start. Rakurai's going to be another step on the same journey, too, and the sword's going to be a huge stride in the right direction. But I want to hit them in as many places as possible. I think it's time to poke up the fire in Coruscant. Prince Davin? Reyno asked, tilting his head while he considered options and possibilities. Exactly. And I want it to coincide with the sword. I want those bastards in Tellisburg to take as many good, heavy kicks in the balls from as many directions as we can manage in the shortest time period possible. If you actually want to coordinate the two operations, Your Grace, we're going to have to tinker with the timing.
What do you mean, tinker?
Forgive me, Your Grace. That was the wrong word. I should have said we're going to have to consider the timing carefully. If we hold to our current planning and send in a team of Carisian assassins, it's going to take at least a few 5 days, possibly an entire month, to get them into position in Delphirac. So the question becomes how closely we want the assassination to coincide with the sword. Do we want to delay events in Sidamark in order to coordinate them with the assassination? Or do we want to move as quickly as possible in Sidamark and settle for approximate coordination between the sword and the assassination? I want them to happen as close to simultaneously as possible, Clintan said after a moment's thought. I want Caleb and Charlian to know we timed them to happen that way. He smiled unpleasantly. After all, they're going to know they didn't kill Davin no matter what happens, so let's just underscore the statement for them and see how they like that. Of course, Your Grace. Reyno bowed across the table again. I'll get started on that immediately. 9. Queen Freyla Avenue, City of Tellisburg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
I have a priority alert, Lieutenant Commander Alban.
Merlin Athroy's head snapped up as Owl's voice spoke calmly over his built-in comm. He stood in the window of his palace bedchamber, looking out into the steadily gathering twilight, and his expression was grim. Tellisburg, even Tellisburg, the city which never slept, which was never quiet, seemed hushed and somber. Lanterns and lamps were already beginning to illuminate the oncoming night, and his enhanced vision could see the longshoremen and the ships still loading and unloading cargo along the waterfront. But the city's tempo had clearly dropped, and people went about their business more quietly than usual, with a degree of fearfulness which grieved his heart. The Grey Wyvern Avenue attack wasn't the only one Tellisburg had endured, although it had been the most costly of them all. Another wagon loaded with explosives had been intercepted as it rolled through the gates of the Tellisburg dockyard. In the wake of Grey Wyvern Avenue, an alert marine sentry had taken it upon himself to question all incoming deliveries unless the driver was known to him personally. His initiative had irritated the dockyard authorities immensely, since it had resulted in confusion and delays in the dockyard's always bustling movement of supplies and deliveries. In fact, his company commander had dispatched a sergeant with orders for him to cease and desist. Fortunately, the sergeant hadn't arrived yet when the officious sentry stopped an articulated freight wagon almost as large as the one used in Grey Wyvern Square. Unfortunately, that wagon driver had arranged one of the flintlock pistol-based detonators where he could reach it from his high box seat. The explosion had killed another 56 people, including the sentry, and wounded over 100 more. But it would have been far worse if the driver had managed to reach his intended destination. Two more similar explosions had racked Tellisburg in the next 12 hours. Fortunately, they'd been smaller,
but they'd created something entirely too much like panic for Merlin's taste. They'd also led to the declaration of martial law, and a decree freezing all wagon traffic until the authorities could put some sort of security system into place. The attackers' tactics had been shrewdly chosen to hit Tellisburg where it was most vulnerable, Merlin thought grimly. Not only had they targeted the leaders of the Empire's government, what had happened to Grey Harbour, Wagner, and Naaman was proof enough of that, but Tellisburg's commerce was its very life's blood. The city's coat of arms, quartered with galleon and freight wagon, was nothing but accurate in that regard, and the grating, rumbling roar of those heavy wagons was both the bane of Tellisburg's repose and the source of a perverse pride. Now those wagons had become a source of fear, not civic pride, for who knew which of them might be yet another bomb rolling towards its destination. Caleb and Charlian had seen no option but to impose unprecedented controls on the movement of freight through the city. No system could be perfect, but they'd moved quickly to begin issuing permits and licenses which were to be carried at all times and displayed upon demand. Moreover, every cargo load would now have to be documented with a detailed bill of lading that would be inspected before it was allowed into the waterfront area or access to any cathedral, church, or public building. Fortunately, the majority of the capital's freight was moved by professional drayage firms, all of which were already required to be bonded and inspected twice a year. Given those records' existence, they'd been able to move far more rapidly than someone like Clinton probably would have expected, and at least limited wagon traffic had been allowed to resume within 2 days of the initial attack. The smaller independents, who hadn't been in the records, were another matter, and some of them were suffering severe economic hardship while they tried to get the documentation and licensing which had never before been required. Baron Ironhill, aware both of the hardship for them and the consequences for the city's economic sector in general, had already set aside a fund to help reimburse some of those independent drayers' losses. Even under the best circumstances, however, all the new inspections and regulations and licenses had begun imposing a significant drag on the Tellisburg economy. The cost of stationing city guardsmen and marines to do the inspecting was going to be a non-trivial budget item as well. Yet even worse was the pervasive apprehension, the fear that yet another attack was inevitable. Tellisburgers refused to be cowed, and their anger at the indiscriminate slaughter of men, women, and children far eclipsed their fear. Yet that fear was there, and Merlin was sadly certain it wasn't going away any time soon. "What sort of priority alert?" he asked Owl tersely now. "A wagon has just entered one of the primary surveillance zones," the AI replied in the same calm tone. "As per your standing instructions, I have placed a parasite sensor in the wagon bed. It confirms the presence of high concentrations of gunpowder." Taylor Ander suppressed a slightly inappropriate urge to swear as he turned the wagon down Queen Frehla Avenue, and one wheel bumped jarringly over the cut granite curb between the roadway and the sidewalk. He had been selected for his mission because of his religious fervour and his Carisian accent, both of which were completely genuine. Unfortunately, he was a tinker by trade, not a drayman, and there'd been less time to teach him the rudiments of managing a heavy freight wagon than he might have wished. The traffic in Tellisburg was also far, far heavier than he'd ever really anticipated, which only made things worse. But at least there were some advantages to the controls on movement the heretics had slapped down. Operation Rakurai's planners hadn't counted on their being able to do that as quickly as they had, and Taylor was unhappily aware that he had neither permit nor license. If he was stopped, there was no way he could pretend to be anything but what he was. On the other hand, There was far less traffic than there had been, so even if he had no license, he also had fewer other wagons to contend with, and hopefully his own poor driving would be less of a problem. It had been, so far at least, and he didn't have much farther to go. He looked along the street ahead of him. Quite a few heads turned, eyes watching him warily as he rumbled past, and he exulted inside at that proof the heretics had been hurt. They were afraid now, and well they should be. It bemused him that they should go through their lives showing so little concern for the eternity of punishment their actions were storing up in Shan Wei's hell, yet react so strongly, exactly as Archbishop Willem and Vicar Zaspar had predicted they would, to a threat to their merely mortal, transitory bodies. He couldn't understand that sort of thinking. But he didn't have to understand to recognize the effect, and he smiled grimly at the proof of what he and his fellows had already accomplished. Lights were beginning to glow in the establishments around him. Most of them were shops or eateries, and he saw couples and families gathering around the tables of the open-air cafes in the comfort of the cool, breezy evening. The traffic around him was primarily pedestrian, with a smattering of private vehicles and an occasional dragon-drawn streetcar. There were very few freight wagons in the area, however, which made Taylor's wagon stand out even more. That was also the reason his wagon was so much smaller than the others had been, because there was nothing here to justify the presence of one of the huge articulated vehicles. The fact that he only had to manage a simple pair of draft horses instead of one of the dragons was an additional plus, but mostly it was because he needed to appear as unthreatening as possible until the moment came. He was simply one more driver, obviously there to drop off deliveries of fresh vegetables for the restaurants, and he reminded himself to smile and wave reassuringly at the pedestrians who stopped as they saw him passing. Ahead of him, on the left, he saw the sentry box and the Imperial Carisian Marines standing guard at the open wrought-iron gate of his target. He wasn't going to be able to get as close as he would have liked, but that had been factored into his plan. His wagon wasn't loaded just with gunpowder. It had been packed with bits and pieces of scrap iron, old nails, cobblestones, and anything else he could find to use as projectiles. When he set off the charge, it would turn the vehicle into an enormous shotgun, hurling its improvised grape shot for hundreds of yards, inaccurately, but with lethal power. He felt the tension coiling tighter at his center as the moment approached. To be chosen for this particular attack had been an enormous honor. His chances of successfully killing his primary target were probably less than even, given how far from the building he'd be when he detonated his weapon, but he could always hope. And according to their best information, the apostate traitor's office faced on the street, and he normally worked far later into the night than this. So there was at least a chance, and even if he missed Wilson, he'd get scores of the bastard's assistance. He was about to strike a devastating blow at the center of all those accursed perversions of the prescriptions, and that... Taylor's thoughts broke off abruptly as a man materialized out of nowhere. One instant he wasn't there, the next he was reaching up, catching the driver's seat grab rail, and vaulting up beside Taylor with impossible fluid speed. Taylor flinched away instantly and automatically, instead of immediately reaching for the cocked and ready pistol grip concealed in the seat beside him, and before he could even begin to recover, a hand moving with blurring speed had caught his left wrist. He screamed as that same hand effortlessly twisted his arm up until the back of his wrist pressed his shoulder blades. Then another demonically strong hand gripped the nape of his neck, and Taylor screamed again as his captor stood upright on the wagon seat, dragging him with him. Even through the pain in his arm and shoulder, the anguish of the iron vice locked around the back of his neck, Taylor's eyes bulged in disbelief as he realized the man who had leapt into the wagon with him was actually holding him at arm's length, with his toes an inch in the air. Then, without even a grunt of effort, the monster who'd sprung upon him leapt effortlessly down from the high seat. Taylor's scream was a shriek this time. Something crunched noisily and agonizingly in his shoulder socket, sending lightning bolts exploding through his entire body as they hit the ground, and his hand was wrenched abruptly even higher. And then the hand on his neck was driving him down. He found himself flat on the paving stones, his useless left arm thumping down beside him with a fresh stab of agony, as if it belonged to someone else, and a knee slammed painfully into his spine, while his right arm was captured and twisted up behind him as casually as the other one had been. Voices were beginning to shout in alarm, and he heard the clatter of boots as at least one of the marine sentries ran towards them, shouting a challenge. But he managed somehow to turn his head. He looked up, and his entire body jerked in disbelief and terror as he saw the sapphire eyes gleaming in the glow of his own wagon's driving lights, and recognized the livery of the Imperial Guard. "I think you and I have a lot to talk about," Captain Merlin Athroyes told him coldly.
October, Year of God, 895. 1. Tellersburg Palace, City of Tellersburg, Kingdom of Old Caris. I, Narman Garrett Bates, do swear allegiance and fealty to Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian of Caris, the young man said, kneeling before the side-by-side thrones with his hand on the cover of the Holy Writ. To be their true man of heart, will, body, and sword, to do my utmost to discharge my obligations and duty to them, to their crowns, and to their house in all ways as God shall give me the ability and the wit to do so. I swear this oath without mental or moral reservation, and I submit myself to the judgment of the Emperor and Empress and of God himself, for the fidelity with which I honour and discharge the obligations I now assume before God and this company. Caleb and Charlian looked down at him, seeing the unshed tears behind those brown eyes, hearing the grief in the young voice which refused to remain completely steady, despite all its owner could do. Caleb felt his own throat closing, and he glanced at Charlian, saw the tears glistening in her eyes as well as they stretched out their hands to cover the boys. "And we, Charlian Ardell Alana Armach, and Caleb Zan Harald Brian Armach," Charlian said, her voice clear but soft, "do accept your oath. We will extend protection against all enemies, loyalty for fealty, justice for justice, fidelity for fidelity, and punishment for oath-breaking. May God judge us and ours as he judges you and yours." There was a moment of intense silence as the three of them gazed into one another's eyes, their hands still joined atop the writ. Then Caleb cleared his throat. "There was a day," he told the young prince kneeling before him, "just over 3 years ago this month, when another prince of Emerald named Narman knelt where you are today, Your Highness. He came as a defeated foe, making the best terms he could for his house and his people, knowing my wife and I, as his sworn enemies, might well have demanded his head in return. He came anyway, despite that danger, and knelt on the same cushion and swore the same oath you've just sworn this day. I'd been raised all my life knowing Emerald was the enemy of Caris. There'd been decades of spying and manoeuvring for position and, finally, war between us. We had every reason to hate one another, and very little reason not to. Last month, that prince died." Caleb had to pause and clear his throat again, and despite himself, his voice was husky when he continued. "He died, protecting his wife and your mother with his own body. He died at the hands of an assassin who murdered 37 other people with the same bomb. He died, having fought with all his marvellous intelligence and wisdom at my side and Charlian's for 3 years. Having fought for that which he believed, for that which he loved, and for that which he gave his life. And my lifelong enemy died, not simply as our vassal, but as my friend, my ally, and my brother. In a few more years my younger brother will wed your older sister, but know this. Our houses are already joined, and while Charlian and I weep at bidding your father go with God, we rejoice at welcoming you to the throne you now assume. I know how much your father loved you, Narmon Garrett, and I know how much you loved him. Remember him, as we will, and follow the example he set for you. If you do that, you'll become not simply a prince to be respected and obeyed, but a man to be loved and celebrated. The young man, who would be 16 Seyfoldian years old, 14 and a half in the years of old Terra, in 4 more 5 days, gazed up at his emperor and empress. Then he bent his head, his forehead on their clasped hands, until Charlian withdrew hers and rested it on his dark curly hair. Narmon Garrett's shoulders quivered ever so slightly, and the empress' smile trembled as she stroked his hair. Then she drew a deep breath. "Rise, Prince Narmon Garrett, Narmon the Third of Emerald. You are summoned to our imperial council, and we have much of which to speak." Narmon Garrett was already taller than his father had been. He was also athletic and muscular, without Narmon the Elder's undeniably portly physique. His eyes were much the same, however, dark and sharp. It remained to be seen if the brain behind them was the equal of his father's, but the signs were hopeful, Charlian thought. The young man had never expected or wanted to take a throne so young, yet his parents had trained him well, both as a potential ruler and as a boy growing steadily into manhood, and those sharp eyes drank in every detail of the council chamber. He was also clearly aware of his youth as he sat in the chair which had belonged to his father. There was a definite nervousness in the ever so slightly too erect posture, in the way he watched whoever was speaking. There was still too much grief in that youthful face as well, and every so often his left hand touched the black mourning band on his right arm. Yet he showed far more composure than many a man twice his age might have, and Charlian remembered a girl-child, even younger than he, who'd also come to a throne untimely because her father had been assassinated. She had always felt close to Narmon Garrett, and now that common bond of murder had drawn them closer still. "I meant what I said in the throne room, Narmon Garrett," Caleb said, looking down the table to where Narmon Garrett sat at his foot. "I didn't expect even to like your father before we met. But both of us were rulers. Both of us knew the survival of our realms and our people required us to find an accommodation. I never anticipated how much we'd come to treasure one another, or how valuable his wisdom and counsel would be. I'm sure you know Charlian and me well enough by now to realize how sincerely attached we were and are to your entire family, little though any of us expected that outcome. And despite your youth, you're a full voting member of the Imperial Council. You are the Prince of Emerald, the second-ranking noble of the Carisian Empire, and we'll value your input and opinions. I'm sure you'll be more hesitant than your father was to offer an opinion." Despite the solemnity of the moment, Caleb's lips twitched. God knows Narmon was never shy about offering opinions. A mutter of laughter ran around the council chamber, and even Narmon Garrett smiled at the Emperor's wry expression. "That hesitancy is only to be expected, given the combination of your age and how recently come to your throne you are," Caleb continued more seriously as the moment's humour ebbed. "When you do wish to speak, however, you have not only the right, but the responsibility to do so. I trust you understand I mean every word I've just said.
I do, Your Majesty. And Your Grace, Narmin Garrett said, bowing down the length of the table to Charlion. His voice hadn't yet settled completely into its adult register, but he met his monarch's eyes steadily. And you're right. For at least a while I'm going to take my mother's advice.
Oh?
Charlion cocked her head. And what advice did Princess Olivia give you, Your Highness? To keep my mouth shut in official settings, even if I think people are going to assume I don't know what they're talking about, rather than open it and prove I don't. Narmin Garrett told her, with something approaching his normal grin. She suggested it would be wise of me to mostly listen until I actually have a clue what the people around me are discussing.
A wise woman, your mother, Your Highness, Caleb observed with an answering smile.
I think so most of the time myself, Your Majesty. Although there have been times when her idea of wisdom and mine weren't exactly the same.
I can imagine,
Caleb said feelingly. Then he shook his head and looked around at the other councillors seated at that table, and his amusement, welcome though it had been, disappeared. Some of the faces had changed. Narmin's left a painful gap, but much as Caleb would miss the plump little Emeraldian, the gap where Sir Regis Yawance had sat for so long was even more painful to him. And yet, as bitterly as he missed the man who'd been his friend, mentor, unofficial uncle, adviser, and finally servant, he felt no qualms when he looked at the man who'd replaced him. Travis Olson, the Duke of Pine Hollow, had been Prince Narmin's first counsellor for many years. But he would be unavailable to Prince Narmin Garrett in that role, because Caleb and Charlion had stolen him for the Empire. Quite a few Carisian noses had been put out of joint by their decision to name Pine Hollow to succeed Grey Harbour, yet no one had complained too loudly. Partly that was because the people who might have done the complaining suspected how little patience the Emperor and Empress would have shown their protests. Perhaps equally importantly, however, was the irreproachable job Pine Hollow had done managing Emerald's affairs, while Narmin was distracted by his responsibilities as Charlion and Caleb's Imperial Counselor for Intelligence. In the process of doing that job, Pine Hollow had also spent a great deal of time in Telesburg, conferring with Grey Harbour and the Council members permanently based there. He'd gotten along particularly well with Grey Harbour himself, and they'd carried on a lively correspondence even when he wasn't in Telesburg. As a result, he was very much a known quantity, with a command of the issues he would confront in his new position, which very few of his new colleagues on the council could have matched, and none could have excelled. There were other reasons to name him to that position as well, of course. One was to demonstrate Caleb and Charlion's willingness to step outside their own realms of Old Caris and Chisholm to fill such a vital position. It was another proof they'd genuinely meant it when they declared that the Empire of Caris was to be an empire of all its peoples. In addition, Pine Hollow had the advantage of having understudied one of the most skilled, cunning, and devious rulers in Safehold's history, which would undoubtedly prove valuable. And, finally, in the wake of Narmin's death, the Brethren of St. Zerno had finally, if tardily, accepted the Emeraldian's recommendation that Pine Hollow be added to the Inner Circle. Caleb would have given literally anything to have Grey Harbour still sitting in that chair. But if he couldn't have that, at least he had someone who was every bit as determined and every bit as intelligent as Grey Harbour had been himself, and one who knew the full truth about the struggle they confronted, and who had access to Owl and the comms which tied the Inner Circle together.
Now, if we could only get those lovable old fossils to let us bring Iron Hill fully on board, Caleb thought.
Then he snorted mentally. Just like you, isn't it, Caleb? Never content, never satisfied. Why don't you just concentrate on the things the Brethren have managed to do right,
and contemplate some of the things they may have kept you from doing wrong instead.
Binzamin, he said out loud, turning to where Binzamin Reis sat next to Narman Garrett.
I suppose we should start with you.
Of course, Your Majesty.
Baron Wave Thunder looked as weathered and solid as ever, yet it was clear he had taken the suicidal attacks hard. His expression was grim, and the mood of the entire council darkened perceptibly as its members turned their attention to him. All of them knew they weren't going to like what he had to report, but only those who were also members of the inner circle knew there was even worse he couldn't report yet.
"As of my most recent figures," he said, "the death toll from all of the attacks stands at 1,716. Over half of those were from the Grey Wyvern attack. In addition, according to the order of Pasquale, we have at least another 25 or 30 in hospital who may yet succumb to their injuries, and over 90 who are expected to live, although some of them have lost limbs."
His voice was harsh, and his eyes met Caleb's. Both of them knew those numbers were low, although neither could say so, since no reports had come in as yet from Chisholm. That meant there was no acceptable way for them to know another 300-plus people had died in Charlian's kingdom. Baron Green Mountain, her own first counsellor and beloved mentor, might still be one of them too, although the healers seemed to have him stabilised.
"The only good news is that we did manage to take at least one of Clintran's agents alive," Wave Thunder continued. "It was only blind luck, of course."
In fact, it had been Owl's, Snark's, and Merlin Athroy's ability to sprint halfway across Tellersburg under cover of darkness at superhuman speeds. But again, that was something he couldn't very well explain to the council at large.
"We were all lucky Captain Athroy's happened to be outside the patent office to notice the wagon approaching the building. If he hadn't become suspicious and overpowered the driver before he could reach the detonating mechanism..."
"Captain Athroy's does seem to have a talent for that sort of thing, doesn't he?" Charlian observed, deliberately pitching her voice to lighten the mood, as she turned her head to smile at the sapphire-eyed guardsman standing just inside the council chamber door.
"He has proved a moderately useful fellow upon occasion, I suppose," Caleb agreed in a judicious tone.
"One tries, Your Majesty," Merlin replied respectfully, and the entire council laughed. A mere bodyguard might not have been expected to reply to an emperor that way in most realms, but this was Karis. The bodyguard was Merlin Athroy's, and they needed that cleansing laughter.
"At any rate, Your Majesties," Wave Thunder said, "the one man we've managed to capture hasn't been the least bit reticent about who he is or why he's here, or even who sent him. In fact, Master Anders is proud to have been personally selected by the Grand Inquisitor as one of his Rakurai. His only regret seems to be that he was captured before he killed himself, blowing up the patent office and as many people who worked in it as possible, and Father Pater in particular. And he's boasted to anyone who would listen that he and his companions were only the first wave of the attacks Clintan intends to launch."
There was no laughter this time, and faces hardened all around the table. "I suppose something along these lines was only to be expected eventually, given how uniformly unsuccessfully they've been in regular military confrontations with us," Pine Hollow said quietly. "Given the timing, it was probably the Markovian Sea that actually pushed Clintan into this strategy, I expect."
"I agree, Your Majesties," Baron Ironhill said, his expression grim. "Granted, it never occurred to any of us, since we tend to think of wars as something in which you try to minimize carnage among civilians and innocent bystanders. We should have remembered that as far as Clintan's concerned, there are no innocent bystanders in Karis. He doesn't give a damn who he slaughters."
His voice went hard and ugly with the last sentence,
and not just because of the carnage Clintan's Operation Rakurai had wrecked. The official report of the murder of Sir Gwilym Manthir and his remaining men had reached Tellersberg as well. In fact, the version of their deaths the Inquisition was trying hard to suppress across Haven and Howard had come to Tellersberg, courtesy of the tiny, highly stealthy, purely passive remote Merlin Athroyes had deployed to within visual range of the Plaza of Martyrs. That remote had seen Gwilym Manthir's final gesture of defiance, and the propaganda broadsheets going up throughout the mainland realms contained a detailed etching of Manthir's spittle hitting Clintan in the face to give the lie to the Grand Inquisitor's claim that Manthir had confessed to all of the crimes and blasphemies charged against him. Yet that remote had also recorded the agony in which those Carisians had died. Iron Hill hadn't seen it, but he didn't need to. Caleb and Merlin had seen it, driven by their loyalty to Gwilym Manthir, and wished with all their hearts they hadn't. Charlian, wiser perhaps than either of them, had refused to look. She honoured Manthir's dauntless courage, yet she preferred to remember him as he had been, unshadowed and unmarred by the hideous death he had died.